Do two ongoing wars mean political trouble for Joe Biden?
If Biden is going to win a second term, it's going to have to be on domestic issues, not international.
Plus, an ancient weapon being used to horrifying effect in Sudan.
We're often seeing some villages that might have been standing one day or 1 month, and the next day they're not there anymore. They've been burned down and there's clear markings to identify that. Sometimes we even catch them on fire as well.
And later, Vladimir Putin warns the West, South Africans go to the polls, and a look at the state of freedom of the press in the United States. Today is Wednesday, May 29th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. We begin in Gaza, where the pier built by the U.S. military off the coast is being temporarily removed. This after a part of the structure broke off, the Pentagon said Tuesday. It's the latest blow to efforts to deliver humanitarian aid to Palestinians. Sabrina Singh is Deputy Pentagon Press Secretary.
Trident Pier was damaged, and sections of the pier need rebuilding and repairing. Therefore, over the next 48 hours, the Trident Pier will be removed from its anchored position on the coast and towed back to Ashdod, where U.S. Central Command will conduct repairs. The rebuilding and repairing of the pier will take at least over a week, and following completion will need to be re-anchored to the coast of Gaza.
Since the pier began operations 2 weeks ago, the UN has transported 137 trucks of aid. It's the equivalent of 900 metric tons, according to the UN World Food Program. There are reports in Israeli media that some of the trucks full of humanitarian aid leaving the pier were robbed and looted by Palestinians, and that Hamas fighters are hoarding it. The war in Gaza is not without its political ramifications in the United States. President Joe Biden, who ran on a campaign to end forever wars in 2020, is now supporting two conflicts in Europe and the Middle East that have cost the American taxpayers tens of billions of dollars and show no signs of ending. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara takes a look at how Biden's policies to support Ukraine and Israel may impact his electoral prospects.
As Israel continues its military campaign in Gaza, a ceasefire for hostage release deal with Hamas appears out of reach, even with extensive U.S. diplomatic efforts. Meanwhile, almost 2.5 years since Moscow's invasion, Ukraine so far has rejected the possibility of ceding territory and directly negotiating with Russia. Emma Ashford, senior fellow with the Reimagining U.S. Grand Strategy Program at the Stimson Center via Skype.
In both cases, you can make an argument that the U.S. has been so heavily involved without necessarily thinking through the consequences of where that leads, that now we're kind of stuck with no good off-ramp in either conflict. And I think for Biden, that's the problem.
President Joe Biden did not commit any American troops on the ground in either war.
There are no American soldiers at war in Ukraine. I'm determined to keep it that way. But we are standing strong with Ukraine, and we will stand with them.
He scored a major foreign policy win in April by securing the passage of a bipartisan foreign aid bill that included $61 billion for Ukraine and $26 billion for Israel. But since then, he has been shifting the focus of his messaging away from foreign wars. Larry Sabato, director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics, via Skype.
If Biden is going to win a second term, it's going to have to be on domestic issues, not international. And he's got some ground to make up in the key swing states. So he needs to focus on the ones that identify with Democratic points of view. For example, the abortion issue.
And he has. In recent weeks, Biden has ramped up campaign engagements, centering his speeches on the economy and other domestic issues, including protecting abortion rights, canceling student debt, combating hidden junk fees for consumers, and boosting manufacturing. Matt Duss, Executive Vice President at the Center for International Policy.
Clearly, they want to focus on areas they believe to be their strengths, but they're not the ones who only get to make that choice. I mean, the world will continue to intrude.
But ultimately, domestic issues are what drive Biden's agenda. A May Reuters Ipsos poll shows that while many Americans are unhappy with the wars, they see inflation as the most important issue facing the country. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Changing gears now, we look at Papua New Guinea, where hundreds still remain missing following the May 24th landslide in a remote northern village. The difficulty continues as search and relief efforts are being hampered by treacherous terrain and tribal unrest. Sean Hogan has more.
Papua New Guinea's Yambali village is unrecognizable, buried under two stories of mud and debris over 3 to 4 football fields in area. Survivors of last Friday morning's landslide dig to try find the missing, but Mate Bagoshi from the United Nations Development Programme calls the search for the survivors a retrieval.
It's basically a mountain that has fallen on their heads.
Mourners gather on the landslide's perimeter. Death toll estimates have varied vastly, with the government saying more than 2,000 were buried alive. The UN estimates about 670 are missing. Community leaders have put the figure at around 200. Only 6 bodies have been recovered.
Because the chances of finding survivors are nearly zero, it's a race against the clock.
Rescue teams have been slow to reach the site because of treacherous terrain and tribal unrest in the remote area, forcing the military to escort convoys of relief teams. Australia's High Commissioner said aid and personnel have begun to arrive, and the United States has also pledged $500,000 to relief efforts. Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape blamed extraordinary rainfall and changing weather patterns for the landslide and multiple disasters the Pacific Island nation has faced this year. Thousands of residents were ordered to evacuate the area over fears of further landslides, with 70,000 said to be impacted by the disaster.
That's Sean Hogan of Reuters. And now to Africa. Investigators using satellite imagery to document the war in Western Sudan's Darfur region say that 72 villages were burned down in April. It's the most they've seen since the conflict began. VOA's Henry Wilkins talks with the people who do this research about holding those responsible for the violence to account.
In London, open source investigators use publicly available information, often from the internet, to find evidence of villages being burned thousands of kilometres away in the war-torn Darfur region of Sudan. Ben Strick is the director of investigations for the Centre for Information Resilience, a non-profit that documents the conflict through a project called Sudan Witness. Sudan Witness says that 72 settlements were burned down in April 2024, the most it has seen in any month since the war began in April 2023.
We're often seeing some villages that might have been standing one day or 1 month, and the next day, they're not there anymore. They've been burned down and there's clear markings to identify that. Sometimes we even catch them on fire as well. At some points, we're even lucky enough to see footage, and often that footage is filmed by the perpetrators themselves who are in the village cheering as they burn down these villages and often kill people at the same time.
Strick says the team has been able to identify some of the commanders who ordered the burning of settlements from these videos. Human rights lawyers say that regardless of the difficulties in getting first-hand testimony, the international community needs to do more to stop the violence perpetrated against Sudanese civilians, even as the wars in Gaza and Ukraine dominate the headlines. Yonah Diamond is senior legal counsel at the Raoul Wallberg Center for Human Rights.
The amount of outrage, rightful outrage elsewhere in the world, can also be directed at Sudan and the appropriate resources directed to protect and end the violence.
Strick says open source investigators will play a crucial role in holding the perpetrators of violence against civilians to account in the future. He says that open source investigation is also important in disproving propaganda.
There are certain elements claiming that they are condoning or that they stand against human rights abuses. However, some of the information that we're digging out shows contrary. And this is really useful because we're able to show the evidence, not just tell it. And that's really important in a space of propaganda and disinformation.
Nonprofits have blamed the paramilitary rapid support forces and associated ethnic Arab militias for carrying out ethnic cleansing and attacks, including the burning of villages, against non-Arab communities in Darfur. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
Elsewhere in Africa, South Africans began voting Wednesday in an election seen as their country's most important in 30 years. At stake is the three-decade-long dominance of the African National Congress Party, which has ruled South Africa since the end of apartheid in 1994. However, it's now the target of a new generation of discontent in a country where half the population is believed to be living in poverty. Final results are expected on Sunday. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Is freedom of the press at risk in the United States? That story coming up in a bit. Now, though, to Kyiv. Russian forces continue shelling across Ukraine, launching more drones and intensifying attacks on the area close to the Russian border. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian Prime Minister met with allies in Prague. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
Early on Wednesday, Russian forces attacked Ukraine with 14 drones. The attack targeted the Kyiv, Chernihiv, Sumy, Cherkasy, and Poltava regions. Ukrainian air defense reported that they shut down 13 of them. Also Wednesday, Russian troops launched a rocket attack on the settlement of Krasnopilye in the Sumy region, which is located less than 20 kilometers from the border with Russia. As a result of the attack, two people were killed and three were injured. The cultural center and administrative buildings were damaged. This is amid warnings from Ukrainian officials that Russian forces are expected to intensify the shelling of the Sumy region and try to launch a land assault similar to the Kharkiv region to create another buffer zone on the territory of Ukraine. Meanwhile, Ukrainian Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal took part in negotiations with Ukraine's allies in Prague. According to the Prime Minister, the participants discussed the Czech initiative to supply Ukraine with more ammunition.
Over 15 countries have already joined this initiative, raising more than 1.6 billion euros. Now it is very important to ensure timely, systematic, and scheduled delivery of ammunition.
The second issue was the provision of air defense systems for Ukraine, particularly Patriot missile systems, and the supply of F-16 fighter jets, which Kyiv expects to receive in summer.
To secure our skies, we need, as a minimum, 7 Patriot systems and modern combat aircraft as soon as possible.
Ukraine's allies also discussed assistance to the Ukrainian defense and industrial complex, particularly the creation of joint ventures, share of technologies, construction of new enterprises in Ukraine, and financing of Ukraine's production. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
We've reported on this show before about the push by Kyiv to convince Western allies to let them use Western-supplied weapons against Russia by attacking targets on Russian soil. Right now, Ukraine is only permitted to use these weapons against Russian forces on occupied Ukrainian land. Many Western leaders are sympathetic to Kyiv's request. Many, but not all. Reuters' Gabe Singer has more.
Vladimir Putin warned the West on Tuesday that NATO members in Europe were playing with fire by proposing to let Ukraine use Western weapons to strike inside Russia. While on a trip to Uzbekistan, the Russian president told reporters on Tuesday that such strikes could trigger a global conflict. Putin also emphasized that many NATO member countries have small land areas and dense populations, which was a, quote, factor that they should keep in mind before talking about striking deep into Russian territory. NATO Security General Jens Stoltenberg recently told The Economist that alliance members should let Ukraine strike deep into Russia with Western weapons, a view supported by some NATO members. Here's French President Emmanuel Macron following a joint security session in Germany on Tuesday.
Les missiles.
We tell them, we're supplying you with weapons, but you can't defend yourselves. We stay exactly within the same framework. We think that we should allow them to neutralize the military sites from which the missiles are fired.
The deadliest land war in Europe since World War II is escalating into what diplomats say is its most dangerous phase to date. Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky recently chided Ukraine's Western allies for not providing enough military support to rebuff Russian attacks, and for prohibiting Ukraine from using Western-provided weapons to strike missile launchers inside Russia. Russia's recent advances have triggered a debate in the West about what else it can do after giving Kyiv hundreds of billions of dollars in aid, weapons, and intelligence. The United States has so far not gone as far as some European allies. Here's U.S. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby on Tuesday.
We're aware of the interest that President Zelensky has expressed in this regard. I would tell you that there's no change to our policy at this point. We don't encourage or enable the use of U.S.-supplied weapons to strike inside Russia.
Kremlin officials say Moscow's patience is wearing thin after repeated Ukrainian attacks on Russian cities, oil refineries, and, in recent days, even against elements of its nuclear early warning system.
That's Gabe Singer of Reuters reporting for us today. Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi was killed in a helicopter crash a little over a week ago. The helicopter he was traveling in crashed in mountainous terrain in foggy weather. But his helicopter was just one of several that were shuttling government officials from the northern part of the country that day. Why was his the only one that crashed? For more, VOA's Michael Lippin spoke with Farzin Nadimi. He's a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, who specializes in Iranian defense issues.
Well, that's a very good question. The three helicopters, the one in the front was a Bell 212, and the second one also was the Bell 212, which was carrying the VIPs, and the third helicopter was a Mil 171. The first helicopter was equipped with a weather radar. The second one was not. But apparently, the pilot in command of the flight was the pilot that was piloting the VIP aircraft in the middle. There is no indication that the first pilot, who usually has a role of pathfinding because of the weather radar in bad weather conditions, was in contact with the other helicopters. They should have been. We don't know. We do not have access to any recording of the pilot's communications. But they should have been in contact, and they should have given forewarnings to the other helicopters in the back that they were encountering some bad weather conditions and low cloud covers. Why the second helicopter could not manage to increase altitude in time to clear the terrain, that's a question that we don't know for sure. Probably for some reason, the pilot was not able to increase the altitude quickly enough. Some technical malfunction might have contributed to this failure, or he was not able to calculate the barometric pressure correctly enough that probably he thought he was able to clear the terrain.
One other curious aspect of this incident was that after Raisi's helicopter crashed, one of the passengers, who is a cleric by the last name of Al-Hashem, apparently survived for several hours because Iranian state media cited two officials who were in the other helicopters after those helicopters landed and tried to call the pilot of the doomed helicopter. They managed to apparently get through to the pilot's phone, and the cleric Al-Hashem, according to them, answered and survived for several hours, although he was later found dead when rescuers reached the site after 15 hours of looking. What do you make of this aspect of the incident?
Yes, indeed, that sounds like a very strange turn of events, that the helicopter seemed to have flown into the terrain. In aviation, they call it controlled flight into terrain. And the pilot seems to be in control of the aircraft. Well, there might be other clues found later that sends us other ways. But for now, we believe that the pilot flew into the terrain by some mistakes or some technical issues. But the attitude of the aircraft at the impact suggests that there was a heavy force of impact. And some of the crew members and passengers are burned badly. However, at some point during the early stages of the impact, probably this individual was thrown out of the cabin by the force of impact, and he miraculously survived the fall. And for some reason, despite the fact that he was not able to move and he was badly injured, he had access to the pilot's cell phone.
It does seem odd, doesn't it?
It does seem odd, given the fact that the flight crews, the pilot and co-pilot, were sitting in the front and they should have absorbed the main force of the impact, and they seem to have burned beyond recognition. But somehow the cell phone of the pilot managed to survive this impact and ended up close enough to this individual for him to answer the phone calls. That would be very strange. That might be what actually happened, but it would be under very strange circumstances.
VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Farzin Nadimi, senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And finally, today in the United States, the country's media are mostly free from interference. Mostly. The U.S. dropped 10 points on the World Press Freedom Index in 2024. Its issues like harassment, arrests, declining trust, and economic constraints that make the work of journalists in the U.S. difficult. VOA's Christina Casiedo-Smith and Michael Lippin have the story, as narrated by Casiedo-Smith.
Several reporters across the U.S. have been detained or harassed while covering the Israel-Hamas war protests. Such incidents, say experts, have a chilling effect. Clayton Weimers is the executive director of Reporters Without Borders U.S. Bureau.
If you go to cover a protest and you get arrested and maybe even a little violently arrested and get hurt, you're going to think twice about how close to that story you want to get next time if you think there's a risk that you're going to end up in handcuffs or worse, spend the night in jail.
The number of press freedom violations in the U.S. dropped in recent years, but incidents like a newsroom raid in Kansas, arrests, and subpoena requests for journalist records contribute to the country's 10-point decline on the World Press Freedom Index. Another factor, says Reporters Without Borders, is hostility from some political leaders. Officials should uphold media as an important part of democracy, says National Press Club President Emily Wilkins.
So I would call on our elected leaders to be brave, to speak the truth, about the media and the role that it plays in the democracy, and realize that for every time that they villainize reporters and the media as a whole, that is a knock against democracy, and that is something that is making our entire country weaker.
Adding to a tougher media environment are economic issues. Analysts see a growth in so-called news deserts where communities have little to no dedicated coverage. The result is fewer reporters left to act as public watchdogs. Cleveland Plain Dealer reporter Sabrina Eaton says she is one of the only reporters left covering Congress for audiences in Ohio.
We're supposed to be letting people know what's going on, and if nobody is there to let people know what their members of Congress are doing, I think that's a tragedy.
Noting unprecedented disinformation and distrust toward media, Weimer says reporters have a big responsibility.
We tend to think of press freedom as the rights of journalists, but there's also an element of it that's the obligations of journalists, and journalists have an ethical obligation to provide objectivity, to cover issues fairly, to be transparent, and to hold themselves to account when they make mistakes.
But not all is lost, says RSF. The Press Act, which has bipartisan support in the House and Senate, will offer greater protection to journalists and their sources from government requests for information if enacted into law. Christina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts.
issues in the news explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.